The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Bible is a unit and presents a harmonious message. That message is clear both in the New Testament and the Old Testament, and the Old Testament serves as a preparation for the New. There is given to us in the Old Testament a history of redemption. A plan of salvation is gradually unfolded, and into that plan every bit has its proper part and its function to play. The critics who divide the Old Testament up into separate pieces and who simply explain it as the compilation and collection of tradition, whether written or oral, are really hard put to it to explain the wondrous unity that results. If the contents of the Old Testament have come from different sources, if they represent really nothing more than tradition that the Hebrews had handed down, be it oral tradition or written tradition, and if this was gathered together by different redactors and collectors, and finally put together in the form that we now have, it's a very remarkable thing that those redactors have been able to come up with the unity that is found in the Old Testament. There is, I say, a plan of salvation, a history of redemption that is unfolded. And I want to consider with you this evening the place that the book of Daniel occupies in that history of redemption. I think that the study of this history of redemption, or biblical theology as it is sometimes called, is one of the strongest evidences for the unity of the Bible and also for its divine authorship. Everything in the Old Testament is based upon the fact that man fell into sin. For the whole plan of redemption is the unfolding of God's purpose in delivering man from the guilt and the power of his sin. And the third chapter of Genesis is really fundamental for the understanding of all that follows. We know that God drove man out of the Garden of Eden. But before he did that, he stated the promise of salvation. And that promise of salvation is gradually unfolded by the prophets. It is first given to us in what we might call seed form, and then it is developed bit by bit, so that as we turn the pages of the Old Testament, we learn more and more about the coming Redeemer and about the salvation that he is going to bring to mankind. Now, for a time, the people of God existed independently, individually, we might say. And it was necessary that God should separate them from the world of unbelief. And so he called Abram from Ur of the Chaldees. It was necessary that the people of God be set apart, distinguished from the world, in order that they might live together. For when men are living in the midst of a sinful world, they find very often that they fall into the practices of that world. If the people of God are separate and belong together, they can strengthen one another. We hear a great deal today about taking religion out on the sidewalks, about going away from Christians. I heard of a minister who felt that it was a sad thing for Christians' families to live close together, that they should break up and go out and live in the midst of unbelieving communities so that they would have a witness. Now, I don't agree with that. I know that we must be in the world, but I know also that Christian people can be a blessing to one another and can strengthen one another. And so God called Abram from Ur of the Chaldees in order that his people might be separated. For a time, the line of redemption consisted simply of the patriarch and his family. He was, you might say, the priest of the family. He was responsible for the education of his family. And then as time went on, we know that the children of Israel went down into the land of Egypt, and there they stayed in bondage. There they were almost engulfed by the Egyptian religion, although to a certain extent they stayed apart. But at his own time, God, mindful of his promises to the patriarchs, brought them out of the land of Egypt. Then he determined to form them into a nation. And they were thus formed. They were given his holy law. And God made it known that he was to be their God. He revealed to them the fact that he was their God by an act of redemption. For he brought them out by a strong right arm from Egyptian bondage. They were established into a nation, and that nation was to be unlike any other nation. It was to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, and God was to be the ruler. The king that God would raise up was to be a man after his own heart. He was in his administration of the kingdom to set forth the justice that characterized the divine dealings with man. He was, I say, to be a man after God's own heart. When finally the people entered the promised land, they found an entirely different situation from that of the desert wanderings. For a number of reasons, they became separated and divided. One of those reasons was geographical. Palestine is a mountainous land, and the people were separated. Even today in Palestine, with all of our modern systems of communication and so on, with modern highways and all the rest of it, if you travel about among the Arabs in Palestine, you will notice differences of pronunciation of Arabic among Arabs that live only 12 or 13 miles apart. And so in biblical times, you can readily understand that the people would have become separated. And we find that time that is characterized in the book of Judges as a period when every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now, because of reverses, the people began to realize that this was not a good condition of things. They needed a central authority. But they wanted a central authority that would be like those in other nations. They asked for a king that would be like the kings of the nations round about them. They did not ask for a truly theocratic king. They did not want to be a distinct, unique people, but rather they wished to be like others. They asked for the king in what we may call an untheocratic spirit. They had learned the lesson that they needed a king, but now they must learn a further lesson that they need a king who is a man after God's own heart. And that was given to them in David. After the experiences with Saul, when things did not turn out as they should, then the people realized that they needed a different kind of a king. When they had asked for Saul to be their king, Samuel said, "You have not rejected me, but you have rejected the Lord. For you're asking," and I would paraphrase the thought, they were asking for the king in a wrong spirit. But then finally, they see that there must be a truly theocratic king. There must be a man after God's own heart. That alone will fit the situation. For the theocracy, and the word simply means the power of God. It comes from two Greek words, the power of God, the rule of God. The theocracy was the kingdom of God, the kingdom in which the rule of God would be manifest. And Israel was designed to be a light to lighten the Gentiles, to bring the knowledge of the true God to all the world. That was the function that Israel was intended to fulfill. Now, as we pointed out this morning, the nation fell far short of that ideal. Instead of doing that, she became faithless. And so Israel had all the weaknesses of any kingdom. And when Solomon was upon the throne, although Solomon was permitted to build the temple for God to manifest his presence in, nevertheless, there was a lack of wisdom in some of the things that he did, and we find that there was rebellion after his death. David had built up the kingdom. David was a man after God's own heart, and yet as we examine the life of David, we realize that he sinned greatly. And because he was a man that shed much blood, David was not permitted to build the temple. Now the name Solomon, Shlomo, at least reminds us of the Hebrew word for peace, Shalom. And Solomon did build that temple. Solomon had asked God for the gift of wisdom. And yet we know that Solomon did depart therefrom. And so following his death, there was the schism. This was a great blot upon the history of the nation. Now the northern tribes went their own way. Jeroboam the son of Nebat erected the two calves, one at Dan and one at Beth, made it known that he was to be their God. He revealed to them the fact that he was their God by an act of redemption, for he brought them out by a strong right arm from Egyptian bondage. They were established into a nation, and that nation was to be unlike any other nation. It was to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, and God was to be the ruler. The king that God would raise up was to be a man after his own heart. He was in his administration of the kingdom to set forth the justice that characterized the divine dealings with man. He was, I say, to be a man after God's own heart. When finally the people entered the promised land, they found an entirely different situation from that of the desert wanderings. For a number of reasons, they became separated and divided. One of those reasons was geographical. Palestine is a mountainous land, and the people were separated. Even today in Palestine, with all of our modern systems of communication and so on, with modern highways and all the rest of it, if you travel about among the Arabs in Palestine, you will notice differences of pronunciation of Arabic among Arabs that live only 12 or 13 miles apart. And so in biblical times, you can readily understand that the people would have become separated. And we find that time that is characterized in the book of Judges as a period when every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now, because of reverses, the people began to realize that this was not a good condition of things. They needed a central authority. But they wanted a central authority that would be like those in other nations. They asked for a king that would be like the kings of the nations round about them. They did not ask for a truly theocratic king. They did not want to be a distinct, unique people, but rather they wished to be like others. They asked for the king in what we may call an untheocratic spirit. They had learned the lesson that they needed a king. But now they must learn a further lesson that they need a king who is a man after God's own heart. And that was given to them in David. After the experiences with Saul, when things did not turn out as they should, then the people realized that they needed a different kind of a king. When they had asked for Saul to be their king, Samuel said, "You have not rejected me, but you have rejected the Lord. For you're asking," and I would paraphrase the thought, they were asking for the king in a wrong spirit. But then finally, they see that there must be a truly theocratic king. There must be a man after God's own heart. That alone will fit the situation. For the theocracy, and the word simply means the power of God. It comes from two Greek words, the power of God, the rule of God. The theocracy was the kingdom of God, the kingdom in which the rule of God would be manifest. And Israel was designed to be a light to lighten the Gentiles, to bring the knowledge of the true God to all the world. That was the function that Israel was intended to fulfill. Now, as we pointed out this morning, the nation fell far short of that ideal. Instead of doing that, she became faithless. And so Israel had all the weaknesses of any kingdom. And when Solomon was upon the throne, although Solomon was permitted to build the temple for God's to manifest his presence in, nevertheless, there was a lack of wisdom in some of the things that he did, and we find that there was rebellion after his death. David had built up the kingdom. David was a man after God's own heart, and yet as we examine the life of David, we realize that he sinned greatly. And because he was a man that shed much blood, David was not permitted to build the temple. Now the name Solomon, Shalomo, at least reminds us of the Hebrew word for peace, Shalom. And Solomon did build that temple. Solomon had asked God for the gift of wisdom. And yet we know that Solomon did depart therefrom. And so following his death, there was the schism. This was a great blot upon the history of the nation. Now the northern tribes went their own way. Jeroboam the son of Nebat erected the two calves, one at Dan and one at Bethel in the north, at Bethel in the south. And the kingdom went its own way, having nothing to do with Judah. There was rivalry between the two nations from this time on. And that rivalry made the two nations a prey for other countries round about. There grew up to the east in the Mesopotamian plain the kingdom of Assyria. Assyria and Babylonia had been powers right along. Now one and now the other seemed to gain the upper hand. But it was during the 8th century before Christ that Assyria became very prominent. And the Assyrian king, Tiglath-Pileser III, was a usurper who was determined to conquer all nations. Now we know what his purposes were because the book of Isaiah states so clearly in the 10th chapter what that man desired to do. And I want to go into that tomorrow morning in greater detail. This man purposed in his heart to make all nations subservient to himself. He was a dictator. And all dictators seemed to be alike. The first thing that he did was to go down to Babylon and make it clear that he was in control, and he put up a statue of himself. Dictators are always doing that. Today they put up photographs of themselves. When I was in Hitler, Germany, Hitler had photographs of himself everywhere in Germany. Mussolini did the same thing in Italy. That seems to be characteristic of dictators, that they want a representation of themselves everywhere. I think one thing that characterizes modern dictators also is that they don't have a sense of humor. I can't speak about Tiglath-Pileser on that particular point. I don't know whether he did or not. I know that the inscriptions which he has left are very difficult to read, but I won't attribute that to any lack of sense of humor. I'll attribute that to my lack of knowledge of the language. But at any rate, he exhibited a good many of the characteristics of dictators. Another thing that characterizes these men is their cruelty. They must have the upper hand. They must have the last say. And that certainly was characteristic of this man. His inscriptions make it clear that he was a man of cruelty. He glories in his inscriptions in the fact that he has put many people to death. And he uses expressions such as, I filled the valleys with their bones. He had no compunctions whatever in the taking of human life. Now Tiglath-Pileser introduced a policy which had been practiced before, but never upon the scale that he used. He would conquer a nation and bring that people under his subjection and then scatter them abroad throughout his empire. In that way, he would destroy their power to withstand him. And that is what he did with his conquered nations. Now Assyria, you see, was gaining the ascendancy, was gaining in power right along. And you have to the south of Palestine, Egypt. In between is this divided country, Judah and Israel. Against Assyria or the Mesopotamian power, they cannot stand. Finally, the Assyrian comes to the north, and Israel is taken captive. Israel is taken captive by Shalmaneser, and the Israelites are taken away from Samaria. Incidentally, that's a very interesting point. The Bible seems to imply, though it does not say so in so many words, that Shalmaneser captured Samaria. An inscription of Sargon has appeared, which seemed to give the impression that Sargon had captured Samaria. And so there have been some who say that the Bible has made a mistake at this point, that actually the city was captured by Sargon and not by Shalmaneser. But further study seems to show that what Sargon is talking about is not the first capture of Samaria, but later incursions, later taking away of captives. And it would appear that, after all, the one who did conquer Samaria was Shalmaneser. These were Assyrians, and first the northern kingdom had to go. Later on, Nebuchadnezzar came to the west, and he conquered Jerusalem. And so both Israel and Judah were taken captive. They were taken out of their land, and there came the period of the exile. Now this is called the period of indignation or wrath. God speaks to the nation through the prophet Isaiah and calls this a period of his indignation. This is the time when the wrath of God is manifested against his people. In the destruction of Judah, the theocracy came to an end. Now, my friends, think for a moment of what that means. Here is the kingdom of God, the rule of God, the power of God. God in Jerusalem would have his people, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, in the midst of a sinful world. But they have so turned against him that they no longer are fit to be his people. And the exile must come. The Israelites must learn the lesson of humility, that they must go through the valley of humiliation in order that they must see that they are to be a servant of the Lord and so bring the truth to the world. They failed, and they failed miserably. And the question may very well arise, what about the promises of God? What about the promises made in the garden? The promises to Abraham and to Moses? What about all of the promises to David? Are these to be forgotten, to be thrown overboard? The nation is no longer in Jerusalem. The Davidic throne is gone, apparently. What then is to happen? Now it is in this juncture that Daniel is raised up. And one of the functions of Daniel is to explain what God's purposes are. Daniel was a man of prayer. In the 9th chapter, Daniel is studying the book of Jeremiah. For Jeremiah had prophesied that the exile would last for 70 years. And now those 70 years are about at a conclusion. What will God do? Daniel in that 9th chapter acknowledges that the exile has come upon the nation because of its sin, because it has not hearkened to all that was written in the law of Moses. And identifying himself with his people, Daniel says, "We have sinned. We have done iniquitously. We have transgressed. To the Lord," he says, "belongs glory and honor. But to us is confusion of faces this day." Daniel was concerned about these things. There may have been very few among the Jews who were concerned. But remember that God never leaves his people without some witness. And sometimes I think we may take it to heart that when we are inclined to be discouraged at the paucity of true believers in the world, we may remember that there are always those who will bear testimony to the truth. God has not forsaken his purposes. And Daniel is raised up in order that he may explain the purposes of God. Now, I said last evening that he was taken just as a young boy to Babylon. And it was in Nebuchadnezzar's second year that Daniel begins his activity of interpretation. Somebody will notice in this second chapter of Daniel a difficulty. It speaks here of the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, and says that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. If you turn back to the first chapter, you remember that it was a three-year period that the youths had to undergo. And if it was a three-year period, that would have occupied 3 years. And now Nebuchadnezzar, in his second year, has these dreams, and his sleep breaks from him. How can we harmonize this apparent chronological difficulty at this point? I think we must call to mind, as we said last night, that this book uses the Babylonian method of chronology. That what it calls here the second year of Nebuchadnezzar would be what we would call the third year of Nebuchadnezzar. That is, there is the year of his accession, which would refer to a part of that year, what we would call his first year. There is then the first year, according to the Babylonian reckoning, what we would call the second year. And then, according to the Babylonian reckoning, the second year, and what we would call the third year. Now, if we assume that Daniel was introduced to his training right away, that would have been during the year of Nebuchadnezzar's accession. He would have been trained during a part of that year, during the first year Babylonian of Nebuchadnezzar, and during part of the second year Babylonian reckoning of Nebuchadnezzar. So you see, there is no conflict. This does not mean 3 full years of 365 days each, that the 3 year period lasted for precisely that amount of time. For the Hebrew method of reckoning would speak of 3 years as including 1 full year and parts of 2 other years. So if you use the Babylonian method of reckoning here, there really is no difficulty. It would be in what we would call the third year of Nebuchadnezzar that these dreams were given to him. Now, this dream was a divinely imposed dream. It was given by God in order that it might serve for Daniel to interpret and to explain the purposes of God. If you look at this chapter, you will see that the king brought in his wise men, his magicians and astrologers and sorcerers and so on, and the Chaldeans, in order that he might show the king his dream. I want to stop for just a minute in this second verse and call your attention to the mention of the Chaldeans. This is said by many to be evidence that Daniel could not have written the book, because in the 6th century B.C. it is claimed that this use of Chaldean in a kind as referring to a group like this was not in use. This is evidence of a later date. In answer to that, I would say, however, that Herodotus tells us in his account that he, in visiting Babylon, met the priests, and the term is used and implies that the Chaldean priesthood had gone back at least as far as the time of Cyrus. That is very close to the book of Daniel. Quite possibly, then, Daniel, writing after the downfall of Babylon, could have used that term Chaldean. I do not think anyone knows enough to say that that is an error of usage. Here the term is actually used to refer to a specific group, probably priests. And in the light of Herodotus' use, it seems to me that we cannot find fault with what is done here. At any rate, the king says that he has had this dream. Then if you will notice in verse 4, "Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac." Now at this point there is a change in the language of the book of Daniel. And I think the best way to translate it is this way. "Then spake the Chaldeans to the king." Now the next word is pronounced Aramith. And I think that simply means that the language to follow is Aramaic. Let me say that Aramaic is a language in many ways quite similar to the Hebrew language. There is a change in the language, and from this point on to the conclusion of chapter 7, the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic. Beginning with chapter 8 again, it is written in Hebrew. Now, why is that? Well, I really wish I knew the answer to that question. There are many theories given, and I'm not sure that any of them is really satisfactory. I'll mention one, and you can take it for what you think it is worth. The section of the book that deals with the Gentile world powers is written in Aramaic. The section of the book that deals in particular with the Hebrews, the people of God, is written in the Hebrew language. Now, I'm not going to say that that was necessarily the case, but it seems to be. I'm not going to say either that that explains everything, for it does not. The minute you begin to think about this, you realize the number of difficulties that are involved. And I am not sure at all that that is really the explanation. New explanations and attempts at explanations are being made quite often. And yet, when you read them, you have the feeling that you really have not gotten very far. At any rate, this is written in Aramaic, in what is called by scholars Kingdom Aramaic, which was the Aramaic that was in use as the lingua franca of the Persian Empire. There are, as I said last night, some very ancient elements in this Aramaic, but it may be that the Aramaic has been brought up to date. At any rate, I cannot myself see that there is anything in the language of the Aramaic which precludes the authorship by Daniel in the 6th century before Christ. I'm well aware of the difficulties that are involved, but I say I cannot see anything that precludes the authorship by Daniel. And so there is a change of the language at this point. It does not mean that the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, but it simply means the Chaldeans answered the king, and then were given a word to indicate the change of language, Aramith, that is, from now on we're dealing with the Aramaic language. And the things that the Chaldeans say are said in the Aramaic language. Now they ask the king to tell them the dream, and they will give the interpretation. And that, of course, raises a question in the king's mind. These men were clever at this sort of thing. And if you give a man a certain interpretation or dream, if he is clever, he can probably come up with some kind of an explanation. One thing that makes me think that is true is that every once in a while I find I'm on the spot. I'm invited to say a few words and haven't known that I was to do it. And you get your thoughts together and you manage to talk for a few minutes. Whether you've said anything or not is another question. But if the dream had been told to them, then they would have come up with some kind of an explanation. And the king very obviously realizes that that is not satisfactory. At least he must know that this is a different kind of a dream. And it is a dream that has troubled him, and he wants to know the certainty of the thing. And so he utters these threats against the wise men. Now Daniel is introduced, and Daniel, if I may just go over this very rapidly, you remember that Daniel, first of all, goes to God and prays that God will reveal this secret. The prayer that is given here is truly remarkable. In this, there is, you will notice, a complete lack of any selfishness. Daniel is praying here that God's name be blessed forever and ever. Even before he asks that his request be granted, he is concerned that God's name be blessed. He speaks of the greatness of God in his prayers, and then thanks God that this secret is revealed, and then he goes back to Arioch. Now, Arioch says, I have found a man, as though Arioch himself were responsible for this. But Daniel takes no credit for this revelation. Daniel gives the credit to the true God. And I think we need to notice that. It is a wonderful introduction to the revelation to be given. Now in this dream, there is a great colossus, a statue. And this statue is of diverse nature. What strikes us is that the head is of gold. And we can see that colossus, the head of gold shining as it were. And then Daniel looks at the other parts of the statue and characterizes them. He relates this so that the king will know that he is accurately describing the dream which the king has. And the conclusion of the matter is set forth in verse 28 when he says unto Nebuchadnezzar, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. There is that phrase, the latter days, again. And that is the key to the understanding. We are looking forward to the messianic time, to the time when God will manifest his purposes of salvation. And so he tells us about this dream and identifies the king himself as the head of gold. Thou art this head of gold. That is the Babylonian Empire, as it culminates in its king Nebuchadnezzar, is the head of gold. I'm inclined to think there is a particular emphasis upon the king here. For Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest of all the Babylonian kings. The power of Mesopotamia has come to its culmination in this king Nebuchadnezzar. He is the head of gold. And then he goes on to say that there will come after him another kingdom inferior to him. Now, if you know Latin, just think of the actual etymology of the word inferior. The Aramaic word is ara, closer to the earth, more earthly, lower in that sense in being closer to the earth, lower than the first kingdom, and then a third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and then the fourth kingdom. And then he sees that in the days of these kings, the four kingdoms, in their days the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And then we are told about this stone that is cut out from the mountain, which breaks in pieces the parts of the image. So God makes known to the king what is to come hereafter, and the dream, he says, is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. Now let's try to see what is intended here. There are four kingdoms, and there is a fifth kingdom, the kingdom of God. Now, if I understand this language aright, what Daniel is saying is that in the days when these four kingdoms exist, the God of heaven will set up another kingdom. And the kingdom which the God of heaven will set up is an eternal kingdom. It will never be destroyed. That is stated explicitly in verse 44. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. Now, this is a remarkable concept. And there are those who approach the Bible with the idea that whatever we find in the Old Testament has to have its roots somewhere else in the world, in some other religion. And so they look for the scheme of four kingdoms followed by a fifth. And learned treatises have been written upon this subject. Where did the writer get this idea of four kingdoms followed by a fifth? I want to say that if you read this carefully, you'll see that that is not what is here. There are not four kingdoms followed by a fifth. But rather, while the four kingdoms are in existence, while the Colossus is still standing, then the God of heaven sets up the eternal kingdom. And that is not found anywhere outside of the book of Daniel. This is a revelation from God. This cannot be duplicated in Persian religion or anywhere else. It is a revelation from God. What are these kingdoms? Well, there are three major interpretations. The first one is agreed upon by just about everybody, and that is that it is Babylon. Well, of course, thou art this head of gold. It says that. But what about the second kingdom? One view is that the second kingdom is Medo-Persia, which actually followed Babylon. The third kingdom is the Grecian kingdom of Alexander the Great. And the fourth kingdom is the kingdom of the Diadochi. And by that word, I simply mean the successors of Alexander, the Seleucids in Syria and the Ptolemies in Egypt that we spoke of last night. That view has been held by some evangelical scholars. I have been told, though I have no knowledge of it, have seen nothing in writing, I have been told that there is a recrudescence of that view in England today. I have not seen anything in writing, however, recently, in which that view has been set forth, and I do not think that it is very widespread. The common view that is held by the critical scholars is this. The first kingdom is Babylon. The second kingdom is Media. Not Medo-Persia, but just Media. Now, actually, the kingdom that followed Babylon was Medo-Persia, the combined empire. And there was no separate Median empire at all, except for a very short time later on, after the time of Daniel. But the critics say the second kingdom is Media, the third kingdom is Persia, and the fourth kingdom is Greece. And there are various reasons given for that interpretation. Then the Messianic kingdom, we are told, follows the Grecian kingdom, as of course it did historically. Now there are several objections to that. First of all, there is this objection that you just did not have a separate Median empire and then a separate Persian empire following it. And the answer that is given by the critics is, we know that, but the author of Daniel, who lived in the second century, didn't know that. He made an historical error at this point. Now, I don't think that myself that there's any warrant for accepting that view. I think it's a very weak view. There's a strong line of evidence against it. I'm simply going to say right now that I think it can be refuted. For one thing, and I'll simply mention this again, it goes contrary to what is stated right here, that the Messianic kingdom is set up not after these four kingdoms, but during the period of the Colossus. Look again, if you will, at verse 44. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. In the days of these kings, it doesn't say after the days of these kings. Therefore, that whole idea of four kingdoms followed by a fifth is really contrary to what is stated here in Daniel. Now there is another interpretation, and I would invite your attention to this. It is, of course, that the first kingdom is Babylon. The second kingdom is Medo-Persia, which followed Babylon. The third kingdom is the Grecian Empire, and the fourth kingdom is the Roman Empire. And if you adopt that position, then you will find yourself in harmony with what is stated here, that in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Now there, it seems to me, is the position that Daniel occupies in the history of redemption. The people are out of their land. Some of them, like Daniel, are concerned. What is to happen? What will God now do? What is the meaning of all this? They had heard the prophecies of Isaiah when he had shown the boasting of the Assyrians, how they would engulf the very kingdom of God if that were possible. And now all this has apparently come to pass. Have the promises been forgotten? No, the revelation is given that the kingdom of man will exist, now in the form of Babylon, then in the form of Medo-Persia, a kingdom that conquered more territory than did Babylon. After that, another kingdom, even that of Greece, a kingdom that conquered even more than Medo-Persia. And then the power of man will come to its culmination, its high point, in Rome. Now that does not necessarily mean just the historical Roman Empire. We'll plan to go into that point more tomorrow night. But Rome, in one form or another, will be the kingdom of man at its greatest. This will be the enemy of God's people. But God himself will establish a kingdom, and his kingdom will be eternal. Even from this, I think we can see that the kingdoms of the Colossus are all essentially the same. All belong to the Colossus. That is a statue, a great statue of a man. All are human kingdoms. in opposition to God's kingdom. But the kingdom that He establishes, He establishes. It is the heavenly kingdom. It is the kingdom that He will establish. And whereas the Colossus will be destroyed by the stone, not cut out by hands, the kingdom that God establishes will endure forever. And that was the message of comfort that God gave to the world through the prophet Daniel at this time when, humanly speaking, all seemed to have gone by the board.